and welcome to the Astr Economic Week in Review. My name is John Eckstein. I am the Chief Investment Officer of Astr Investment Management. I am joined today by my wartime consigliere, Nick Porter. Nick, hello.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me on.
We have a full week of, there's actually more data than you'd think came out this past week. There's a lot, there's FOMC, industrial production, lots of stuff. But first, I want to talk about my sort of economy in a nutshell. So for a while, I've been saying that we were looking for any sign of either additional weakness in the economy after the bounce back from the summer and the fall, or a sign of self-sustaining momentum. And I would have to say that the more high-frequency data is pointing towards renewed economic weakness, not strength. What do you think overall, Nick?
I think that's right. You know, as I've said before, as goes the pandemic, so goes the U.S. economy. So as we've seen a second wave and shutdowns along with that second wave, we've seen increased weakness in some segments of the economic data.
Yeah, I would agree with that overall. So let's start out with the labor market like we usually do. It's Thursday, so we've got the unemployment insurance claims. Those numbers were a little bit disappointing today. The seasonally adjusted numbers were higher at 885,000 versus an expectation of 818. The non-seasonally adjusted numbers did tick down, but they were higher than they were a few weeks ago, which is definitely going in the wrong direction. Another thing that's interesting is that at this point, in terms of continuing claims, the number of people who are receiving jobless benefits, the numbers on the emergency programs match the numbers of people on the traditional state program. So there's about 5.5 million in both the traditional state program and 5.5 million in the additional emergency programs.
Right. And just to clarify, John, I think that so the continuing claims fell from that 26-week cap on benefits and as people move to PEUC, which is additional 13 to 20 weeks, depending on the state.
Yeah. And so actually, interestingly, we are in the 39th week of the pandemic. So there are people who were unemployed, you know, in January or February have already fallen off. And the people who, you know, started filing for unemployment benefits and haven't worked since the first week of this unemployment insurance bonus, they're starting to fall off too. As we are talking, there's machinations on the Hill to extend some of the emergency aid. Like, what's your read of that, Nick?
I think it's good. I think it'll go some distance to making sure that people can stay afloat. For me, the big question mark is the lack of any sort of support for states or municipalities, which have been pretty heavily hit. And so that remains a big red flag for me.
That's true. We don't know. The problem is like the four people or whatever in the room really know what they're talking about. From reports we've seen, one is like they're talking about stimulus checks, but in return for stimulus checks, extending the unemployment benefits only 10 more weeks instead of 16 more weeks or whatever. So that seems bad. But the stimulus checks are probably good. On the other hand,
right. In politics, something is better than nothing. So I see it as a positive development overall.
Yeah. And even so, the stuff I was looking at the other day, the reports I was looking at the other day did show there's no unconditional grants to state and locals, but there's, you know, $20 billion for mass transit, and then there's money for schools, and there's money for roads. And so they're piecing it out bit by bit, but not making unconditional grants. So I think it added up to about $100 billion going out to states and localities.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things we'll have to wait and see and see what comes out at the end.
Right. Agreed. Okay, I think next in importance might be the FOMC. You were talking before the podcast, Nick, and you saying more of the same. Is that your view?
Yeah. So I think there are two questions on the mind of market participants with regards to the path of monetary policy. And neither of them, to be clear, have anything to do with rate hikes. So if you look at the Fed funds future implied or overnight index swap implied path for the Fed funds target rate, both see that rate around 18 basis points in 2022 and, you know, like 37 basis points in 2023. And those are actually more hawkish than the Fed's own dot plot projections, which really show no movement until 2023. So the real questions that people are coming into FOMC meetings with are around the longevity and the pace of QE. And I think on the former part, the longevity, we got something approximating an answer. So the FOMC changed its time horizon for asset purchase from, quote, over the coming months to until substantial further progress has been made, which I guess I would interpret as slightly more dovish. On the latter part of that, there weren't really any potential changes to either the composition of asset purchases or the amount. So it seems like the FOMC is happy where they are now.
Yeah, I would agree with that. They're going to keep on doing the same thing for a long time, which is at this point at least $80 billion per month of treasuries and $40 billion of agency mortgage backs. 12 of the 17 members polled see policy requiring interest rates at zero through 2023. As you point out, the Fed Fund Futures is sort of just taking the Fed at their word. Actually, the funny thing is if you look at their dot plot, it's where our rate's going to be well, at the end of 2020, they're going to be 25 basis points, 5 basis points, I guess, right? Mm. And then same thing in 2021, same thing in 2022, same thing in 2023. And then we get to the longer run, they're magically back up to 2.5%. So, like, when is that? Where are the underpants gnomes going to come in and drag rates up? I don't understand that. And a couple other points worth pointing out. Powell did mention, you know, we've talked about inflation expectations, at least measured by market measures, like drifting up. And that's exactly what the Fed wanted to have happen, right? Like that was the goal, to move inflation expectations up and keep inflation expectations from dripping into deflation. So when we talk about inflation expectations drifting up, like, which remember that was the Fed's exact goal. Now it could be like Sorcerer's Apprentice and it gets out of control. That's not impossible. I don't think it's likely. But that was the Fed's goal and they achieved it.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point that they're not just looking for actual inflation in the near term, but sort of our knowledge of where inflation is generated from. Part of that is inflation expectations. So in some sense, they've achieved a portion of their goal by seeing those drift upwards.
Agreed. And one more thing that's worth pointing out is that if you look at the Fed does still have ammunition, right? If you look at the Federal Reserve's treasury holding by maturity, you'll see they peak at 2021, right? So of all the things they hold, they've got, you know, by far the most in the next 2 or 3 years, like more than, you know, 50-60% of their holdings. And if you go out 30 years, their holdings are very small, you know, maybe 5% of their aggregate holdings. So if they feel like rates are moving up, long-term rates are moving up prematurely, they can do another operation twist and get them back down. But operation twist is basically they sell their bills or they sell their one-year bonds and they buy 30-year bonds and just move, just force the end of the curve down to where they want it.
Right. I mean, there are, as you've said, there are other options on the table. I think they would like to avoid something like explicit yield curve control that we've seen in other countries around the globe, but it is a possibility if things worsen.
They've done it before. We thought we might talk about import prices a little, mainly as a way of getting at the dollar. So import prices, actually, forgetting about crude oil, are even on the month and down 1% year on year. People are worried about the dollar. What's your opinion about it, Nick?
Yeah, so I think one of the questions, and this sort of ties into the conversation we've had on inflation, is that one of the questions we've had around future inflation is the ongoing weakness of the dollar and any corresponding import price passed through to U.S. consumers, meaning that as the dollar weakens in real terms, imports from abroad are more expensive. So in real effective terms, meaning weighted for trades and prices, the dollar is down about 10% from its peak in March. And in like nominal terms, it's down about 13%. But the weakness in import prices suggests that there's still substantial slack in supply capacities and, you know, weak demand if import prices are still quite low, even with the dollar weakness.
Yeah, and let's just, so for people who don't follow the dollar every day, let me just recap sort of the broad strokes. Is that the dollar in the crisis in March and April, the dollar appreciated sharply by about 10%, and now it's depreciated against our trading partners by about what, like 15%, you said, from the peak. And is lower than where it started the year for most things. And so that makes imports relatively more expensive, and in some sense, you would think would lead to inflation.
Right. Yep. And I think it's rather telling that we haven't seen that show up in import prices, right? And it suggests, as I've said, that there's still slack out there.
And then we see that in the global macro world, like one of the absolute consensus trades is dollar weakness. And the source of that would be expected to be the relatively low interest rates in the US compared to the rest of the world, right? So for the last few years, the US has had higher interest rates than our counterparts. And so that usually leads to a stronger currency. And now with the Fed basically saying every time it meets, and nope, we're not raising rates anytime soon, like even though the rest of the world isn't doing much better, I think the US rate expectations have been shifting down, and that's been one of the big things leading to the dollar weakness. In fact, the US economy is probably stronger than most of our trading partners, maybe the emerging markets, China in particular, excepted.
Yeah, it is interesting. What you saw in March obviously was a play towards dollar haven. And you can argue that the dollar weakness of late has been driven by interest rate differentials, but I think it is also part of a risk-on trade, people seeing the economy more broadly, globally, recovering and sort of a flight to riskier assets in emerging markets and developing nations.
That's true. That's a good point. Like, so part of the dollar's spike in March and April was just people want something safe. And I think you see the same patterns in, like, the Swiss franc and other safe havens.
That's right. The U.S. Treasury recently labeled the Swiss a currency manipulator.
They did. We'll see about that. It's interesting to see how many of these executive actions will hold around in the new administration.
Yeah.
I did want to touch on manufacturing, which has been It's been sort of a bright spot of the recovery, certainly recovering faster than services. But the last couple of weeks has been, it's still going up, but has been a little bit disappointing. Capacity utilization is holding steady at about 73% when it should be more like 78% in a recovery. And its pace of growth has dropped. The pace of manufacturing production came in under expectations. People were expecting an 8% month-on-month growth. It actually came in at 4%. I think that even though the PMI surveys, which we talk about, the purchasing manager surveys, have been optimistic, the numbers that we're getting are not quite as optimistic. And when you break it down, it looks like the business equipment is much weaker than the consumer goods. Consumer goods are about to even on February, while business equipment is still substantially below where they were in February. So retail sales did come out today, and they were definitely disappointing. Economists usually look at something that's called retail control, which is backing out auto and gas from the retail sales numbers. That number was expected to be up slightly, and it was down substantially, and the first drop since April. So this is a November number, by the way. So the retail sales is very odd compared to either a normal recession or a normal expansion. So the retail sales are much, much higher than they were in February. And so that's kind of good overall. And they're much higher than they were if you take about, you'd say we're 10 months into a recession, compare that to the 2008 Great Recession recovery. They don't look anything like that. So I think that the difference in expectations might be part of it. It's just like, this is such an unusual period that Wall Street economists are having a hard time getting their hands around it. Of course, you see that the sales at grocery stores are still very strong year on year. The sales at bars and restaurants started dropping again. in November. Like, none of that's a super surprise given the additional shutdowns, the cold weather, but it is more evidence on the weakening side of the balance sheet.
John, do you have any expectations for the holiday season and whether retail sales will match previous holiday seasons?
Oh boy, I mean, the holiday season is going to be interesting. We talked, I believe, last week about how it's going to impact the seasonal adjustments for the labor market, right? Because the seasonal adjustment patterns are going to be different than typical. I think most people are expected to spend less money than last year. Obviously, like, people aren't going to the Rockettes, right? A million people a year go see the Rockettes. Like, it's insane how many people go to see that.
I still haven't. And our office is used to be right above the Rockettes.
I know.
So, well, shame on me.
Well, maybe we can have a little group outing next year. So, like, all that stuff is not happening. So I would guess overall, nothing. I think it's going to be lower overall. Like, maybe people buying more stuff and less fewer experiences, and net lower overall. Do you have an expectation?
No, I think that sounds right. It's going to be, I think it's going to be an interesting data point to watch, and certainly the seasonal adjustment will be tricky.
It will. You know, it's going to be till February before we get a decent number, right? Because December is going to look much weaker than expectations, and January will probably look stronger. And so then we'll be a couple months of excitement.
Yep.
Did you want to bring up something about the rest of the world? We have Nick's foreign desk. What do you got?
Well, on the subject of monetary policy, I thought we could talk about the European Central Bank, the ECB's pandemic insurance purchase program, which is somewhat similar to the central banks here in the States, quantitative easing. And so that facility was launched in March. And from the outset, it was somewhat fraught politically because the ECB had previously pledged to buy only one third of any EU country's sovereign debt, which they
right, and that was basically Germany insisting that, right? No, Germany and the Dutch insisting that you can't bail out Greece and Italy.
Exactly right. And then a German court had a ruling in May that they might have run afoul of EU law, and they've also been buying sovereign debt from below investment grade EU countries, which again is against one of those self-imposed rules. And so this is all part of the political drama in Europe around debt mutualization. And the ECB would really rather not step into that. And so last Thursday, as a second wave ramped up in Europe, the ECB extended its time frame for that facility and similar facilities to earlier 2022.
And that was over the objections of the Germans, right?
Certainly domestic German policymakers. It's not totally clear what the council itself decided.
Right, right. All right, I think we'll leave it there unless you want anything else you want to bring up.
No, I think we hit all the high points.
Definitely all the high points. You can't imagine much higher than that. Next week, Nick is going to be on a well-deserved vacation, and I think we're going to drag Mac back into the podcast. We'll probably recap the housing market, which we haven't done in a while. We'll talk about consumer expectations. We'll have jobless claims, and we can talk about personal income and personal spending. Very interesting numbers there. In the meantime, if you would like even more information, you should check out the Aster blog on asterim.com. You can check out the Aster research app from your smartphone. And that's it. Thanks for tuning in. Please leave a review us and tell somebody if you enjoy this podcast. Nick, have a great weekend.
Thanks, John. Happy holidays.
Thanks. You too.
To learn more about Aster Investment Management's research and strategies, please visit us on the web at www.asterim.com or stay up to date by following us on LinkedIn, Twitter, and our app is also available on the App Store and Google Play. Thank you. Aster Investment Management, LLC, is a SEC-registered investment advisor. All information contained herein is for informational purposes only. This is not a solicitation to offer investment advice or services in any state where to do so would be unlawful. Analysis and research are provided for informational purposes only, not for trading or investing purposes. All opinions expressed are as of the date of publication and subject to change. They are not intended as investment recommendations.